the authoritarianism is predictable when you're in a position of authority and you no longer know what to do or how to do it. Polman, when he was group chief executive of Unilever, on leaving, said something remarkable, which I remember, very vividly. And he said, the expertise and knowledge that qualified me for the top position yesterday is precisely the expertise and knowledge that disqualifies me from knowing what to do today. And I think what happens when people are in power, when they're politicians or they're CEOs of companies, and they don't know what to do, the easiest thing to do is to instruct and to say, do this or do that, or this is what we're going to do. So the kind of authoritarianism we're seeing around the world, in one sense, is a result of us dealing with the complexity and not knowing what to do and taking the easier path by saying, okay, we'll do this. The other thing, the other element that's part of that is that, and this has been proven by research only recently, that the heating climate universally, globally, which I don't know what your beliefs are, but it, for me, it's not a belief. It's just a fact. It's scientific. And it's been proven that heat in the atmosphere can cause us humans to be more irritable, to get more frustrated, to get more angry more easily than before. And I think that too is a component of the authoritarianism that's arising around the world. There are other factors, obviously, but they're the two that really interest me.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast, a podcast about having easy conversations. I'm your host, Furkan Dandia. This week's episode, I welcome Richard David Hames, and we talk about systems thinking, leadership, civilization, artificial intelligence, governance, and the future of humanity. Richard brings decades of experience as a philosopher, activist, author, mentor, and strategic foresight practitioner. Together, we explore why the world feels increasingly unstable, why old systems struggle to respond to complexity, and what it means to think in terms of whole systems rather than isolated problems. Our conversation moves through authoritarianism, social media algorithms, education, leadership, AI, and civilizational transformation. Richard offers a hopeful yet sober perspective. Humanity may be in a painful transition in which the old must dissolve before the new can emerge. Richard David Hames is a philosopher, activist, author, mentor, and strategic foresight practitioner working at the interface between business, politics, and society. He is known for pioneering deep design, a regenerative approach to second-order change rooted in the dynamics of complex living systems. His work spans governance, whole system solutions, strategic foresight, organizational transformation, and the future of humanity. He has advised governments, institutions, multinational corporations, entrepreneurs, and leaders around the world, and is the founder of the Center for the Future and chairman of the Asian Foresight Institute. Before we jump into the episode, a quick reminder that the contents of this podcast are for educational and informational purposes only and have no affiliation with my therapeutic practice. Listening to this podcast does not establish a therapeutic relationship, and if you are seeking support, please reach out to a licensed clinician. Now let's just jump into the episode. Richard, welcome to Easy Conversations. Thank you for joining me today. Evening for you, morning for me, but really looking forward to our conversation. I've had an opportunity to read a lot of your work over the last few weeks, and I'm amazed by how much content you put out there. I'm definitely going to ask you about how you're inspired to continue and what type of discipline you use. But before we jump into our discussion today, I'm interested to know a little bit more about yourself, who you are, and where you are in your current chapter of your life.
It's been a long story, and I haven't really had a career so much as a journey which I've paid attention to in terms of opportunities and wanting to do different things. And really, Fahan, it started, I can remember the day vividly, the day before my 13th birthday. I was lying on the downs in southeast England above Cookmere Haven, feeling very homesick for Australia and acknowledging the incredible education I was getting, but also realizing that it had nothing to do with me. It was about all the problems of the world that had been solved by everybody else and nothing really related to my own personal experience of the world. And it was on that day that I decided that come what may, I would live an extraordinary life. That was my pledge to myself. And I've more or less tried to do that. But having stuck to that path, it's not been a career. I've done very different things. I've been different things to different people. And I'm now coming up to my 81st birthday this year and thoroughly enjoying life. And the pledge I have now is that on the final day of my life, whenever that is, I want to be able to go out absolutely used up and exhausted, but shouting, hey, what a ride that was.
Yeah. You look pretty fresh and good for 81. What's your secret, man? Has it been just this desire to keep going and learning and sharing?
Curiosity yeah. of the world. And I've done a lot of travel. Mm-hmm. I've worked with so many people around the world. I've been so privileged in working with some amazing people and groups. And they've offered me incredible opportunities to grow and to mature and to think differently and to open up to different cultures. I think that's part of it. I also have 10 children, and children keep you young. Yes. And my youngest, I actually homeschool as a single parent. He's on the autism spectrum, and he's teaching me incredible things. That's another thing. And the third thing is I've had 4 relationships. So I've loved 4 women in my life and still do. And each time the relationship has got younger. So my current partner is only 37 years old. And youth keeps it. We live a celibate relationship, but it's inspiring and it's gentle and it's intimate in a way which is different to all of the others. Mm-hmm. I think that keeps me young as well. And but curiosity.
And what I hear in a lot of the things you're sharing is you're constantly growing as well, right? You're doing things differently, which allows us to grow. And often we get stuck in a bit of a box around how society defines what things need to be, even like a relationship, for example.
Oh, yes. With my relationships, for example, my previous relationship, I'm actually in her house now. We're such good friends. We support each other. We still love each other. And this whole notion of you must divorce when that happens or this happens, absolutely not. So with everything in my life, when I come across a problem or an issue, I go back to first principles and think through what I want rather than what's the conventional wisdom in this situation.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like the word philosopher gets thrown around a lot, and it's been used over since for millennia, right? So how do you internalize that for yourself? What does that mean for you?
That's a lovely question. It's a question I've never been asked. For me, it's working that curiosity at a civilizational level. I'm fascinated in terms of the human family, the richness of the human family, the diversity, and the way we all interpret the world and our reality differently. That's what I find intriguing. Mm-hmm. And most of my work has been probably at that level. Bruno Latour, actually, months before he died, was very kind and noted that the work I've done in civilizational theory and world system theory has been seminal. So I think that's where my effort mainly is.
Mm-hmm. So what you talked about, that very early age of being 13 and having this realization. So what shaped your ideas, or what has continued to shape your ideas? What were your early influences to perhaps push you in that direction?
My early influences were probably music. I was a cathedral chorister in England. And it was inevitable that the whole ethos and ambience of that upbringing would have an impression. And for my early years, apart from a brief stint in medicine, which didn't really come off, my early years were devoted to music. I'm a published composer and conductor. And I really thought that was going to be my life's path. But I was writing music which was called The New Complexity. And that probably gives you an inkling as to the kind of music it was, in terms of giving your ears a good bashing.
Yeah.
And it turned out that musicians had to be really dedicated to learn the music, which was so difficult to learn. And then they'd spent 4 months or 5 months learning the piece, the numbers of people that actually wanted to listen to that music was diminishing rapidly. And so it was in 1984, I think, that I made the decision, which was one of the most profound decisions of my life, to stop writing music and use words instead to write books. It was a traumatic moment, but it was, in a sense, inevitable.
No, I appreciate that. And as I mentioned at the beginning, you write a lot, right? So what keeps you going? How do you keep yourself accountable? What is the discipline behind your approach to be able to write so frequently and so much?
There are two factors. The first is my head is so full of ideas. I just need to get those ideas out. Yes. And they come out fully formed. I don't really type or write a book. I actually compose it and speak it. I use a voice-to-text app. And so, and this is important because I have arthritis in my fingers. So if I was relying on typing, it would be much slower. But also, a lot of the ideas stem back a long way. So the book I've just published, which is called Dancing with the Future, was started 28 years ago. And so a lot of the time, I'm actually completing and fulfilling the ideas that were germinating then, but have come to fruition now after a lot of reflection and contemplation and deep reflection.
Yeah, and we'll definitely come back to some of the ideas there too. But you've been around for a while, right? 8 decades. You've traveled the world. What are you seeing in the world now, in today's world? Why does it feel so unstable? Or is it just, it's always been that way, and we're seeming to, because of globalization and our ability to connect with everyone, it just seems that way?
I think probably both. I would imagine that previous generations, to some extent, thought the same about change. But there's a key difference for us, because in terms of civilization, civilizations have come and gone. We've been able to compost and them and their ideas and create new civilizations. The key difference today is that you've mentioned is our interconnectedness, that we're all in the same boat. We are creating the conditions universally that are not at all helpful in terms of sustaining life. And so we've reached a very critical point, I think, which is different. It's unique to what's happened previously. Now, one of the problems is that what we rely on to gain stability, a kind of anchoring of our identity and purpose, has been subjected to, I'd call it destruction in terms of propaganda. You cannot now rely on any mainstream media at all, and probably even less on social media, to find the truth or distinguish between different things. I think it's very different now. And I think that's both an opportunity, well, a problem and a huge opportunity for the human family to come together and think as one, rather than the fragmented world of collapse that we're currently in. And a necessary component into coming out to form something new and different.
Yes, I agree with you on that. But to your, because of the propaganda and the fragmentation around that, how do we find that opportunity to come together, right? And maybe there's parts of it happening in different parts of the world, but collectively, I just see it, the distance growing as opposed to us coming together.
Yes, that's a very accurate way of saying what's happening, in fact, because it's and it's fragmenting and it's a coming together. There are things happening in terms of individuals and communities around the world. It's very patchy, but there are wonderful things happening that you would have to say, you would hope could be the future of our species in terms of governing differently, of thinking about relating to each other differently and to the world, the living world we rely on. But we've also got that fragmentation going on. I often use the analogy of the dissolving chrysalis. So in the chrysalis, it's just melting. The immune system of the caterpillar tries to fight the cells that don't fit, the imaginal cells, but they carry the DNA of the butterfly. And so we're in that state at the moment of limbo in between the dissolving caterpillar and the emerging butterfly. And I think the imaginal cells need to find each other, link up. And that's what happens in biology, in the chrysalis. And that's what we want to do in the world. We want to find each other, and then we can scale. And I think probably the key, rather than thinking conventionally about monumental change, that, you know, here is the paradigm we're in at the moment. Here's the paradigm we need to reach for. I don't think it works. I think it's more atomistic than that.
And I think part of it would be helpful to understand what are some of the challenges and the problems that we're seeing. And one of the things you've talked about in detail is the rise of authoritarianism, right? So what are you seeing in that, and how are you yourself able to predict to a certain extent that coming into fruition?
Okay, so there are two questions there. The authoritarianism is predictable when you're in a position of authority and you no longer know what to do or how to do it. Paul Polman, when he was group chief executive of Unilever, on leaving, said something remarkable, which I remember very vividly. And he said, "The expertise and knowledge that qualified me for the top position yesterday is precisely the expertise and knowledge that disqualifies me from knowing what to do today." And I think what happens when people are in power, when they're politicians or they're CEOs of companies, and they don't know what to do, the easiest thing to do is to instruct and to say, well, do this or do that, or this is what we're going to do. So the kind of authoritarianism we're seeing around the world, in one sense, is a result of us dealing with the complexity and not knowing what to do and taking the easier path by saying, okay, we'll do this. The other element that's part of that is that, and this has been proven by research only recently, that heating climate universally, globally, which I don't know what your beliefs are, but it for me, it's not a belief. It's just a fact. Mm. It's scientific. Mm.
Yes.
And it's been proven that heat in the atmosphere can cause us humans to be more irritable, to get more frustrated, to get more angry more easily than before. Mm. And I think that too is a component of the authoritarianism that's arising around the world. There are other factors, obviously, but they're the two that really interest me.
Okay. And what about, like, so again, bringing it back to propaganda, I suppose, so maybe there is an aspect of the vulnerability to getting angered easily. But what I notice a lot of the times, it's playing on people's emotions, right? Mm. Whether it's fear or anger, which I think are often connected. But to your point, even before that, not trusting the media or social media, but that's where people are consuming a lot of their information, and then they're responding with their emotions.
Yes.
So it's all packaged together, right?
Yeah, we have to understand that the algorithms are manipulative, and they're manipulative because the platforms need to make money. It's all about money. The paradigm that we're in, which I call industrial economism, indicates that it started in the Industrial Revolution, and it's dominantly a paradigm of more production, more consumption, and like a Ferris wheel accelerating that you can't get off. So the platforms need to make money, and they've learned that the algorithms that cause fear and outrage particularly hold our attention. And if they can hold our attention, they make money. So that's part of it as well. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So one of the things when we were talking about authoritarianism, you had predicted was with the United States. And now there's a lot of conversation there. We talk about democracy. And to me, it doesn't align, right? So meanwhile, there's focus on the third world and trying to implement democracy in those parts of the world. But when you look at the United States, what is your perception of democracy there? And do they need to focus on themselves first before they start looking at other countries?
The U.S., the land of the free, has never been a democracy. Mm. It was never conceived by the founders as a democracy. A protection racket. And the U.S. is in a stage of collapse. If you look internally at the infrastructure in the U.S., which I'm sad about because it's an incredible country with incredible diversity of people, until perhaps 20 years ago, it fully entitled to claim the kind of moral authority that it had in the world. But after 2001, it started losing that moral authority, if it did have any, at a rate of knots. But if you look at the infrastructure, if you look at bridges and roads and pavements, if you look at homelessness, if you look at the educational system and what it's actually producing, you look at the healthcare system, it's really, when we talk about the U.S. in the news, we're talking about Washington, D.C. We're talking about the governance of the U.S. When you talk about the U.S. as an imagined community of people, you're talking about a community in distress. So I think what the U.S. is doing is an example of what we need to go through in order to, in terms of at a civilizational level, to come out with the other side with different values, a different proposition, different principles to live by, which are mostly relational rather than transactional. Inevitably create a different kind of relationship between, not just between humans, but between humans and the planet and other life, the non-human life that we rely on and that we've tended to dismiss and not being real life. Whereas in fact, I mean, it's actually quite extraordinary. If you look at some species, if you look at an octopus, for example, and the eight brains it has and how it functions, for us to pretend that that is not sentient life, it's really ignorant.
And some of the things you're touching on, I wanted to ask you about too, was in terms of improving like businesses and government, you talk about whole system thinking. What is whole system thinking to ground up myself and the audience that perhaps don't understand what that means?
Okay, so when I talk about whole systems, I'm talking about if you take you or me as human systems, that is a whole system. We are complete in ourselves. We can persist. We can endure. We can live. We can think. We can look forward. And our energy comes from the relationship we have with others. It's the ubuntu. I am because we are. And so whole systems are sets of relationships and dynamics in constant change. And you can scale that to the human family, which is 8.5 billion people now on the planet. You can scale it to the planet itself, or Gaia, which is a living system in its own right. So what I'm talking about in the whole systems is systems that can endure, that are viable in their own right, but rely on relationships and communication and identity and purpose to be able to do that.
And you've talked about purpose a couple of times now. What does that mean from your perspective? Because I feel the word purpose gets thrown around a lot too nowadays, and everyone's talking about finding their purpose or living life with purpose. What does that mean in this context from your standpoint?
The thing I've never understood is the homogenization and standardization of everything. If you just take education, for example, the notion that we're all the same, and so we can sit the same exam and should be able to remember the same, regurgitate the same facts, is really only preparation for what was required in the factories in the late 18th century. It's not what's required today, in that we still have that same system. For me, the most important thing about a human being is that we are all a gift. We are all unique. We are creative. We all bring our own understanding and identity and ideas and relationships and everything about us. We're unique, as fingerprints are unique. And I think the world that denies that, that tries to suppress that, is not a good world to live in. And so in terms of human purpose, what I look for is liberty and freedom of that gift that we have. The greatest gift, of course, is to love and be loved and to be able to help each other. That's the greatest gift.
And do you feel culture can sometimes influence that, whereas in the West, it's a bit more individualistic, which aligns with that whole idea of being unique? But then in collectivistic cultures, you're again kind of put into a bit of a box that, you know, this is your responsibility to the group, whether that's the family or the tribe. And then that uniqueness is sometimes lost. But you see a lot of collectivistic cultures thrive because there is that unitary aspect of it, right? Which is something else you're talking about. Do we need to be so binary at times?
No, that's one of the real problems that we have. If you go back to the principles of industrial economism, which includes predatory capitalism, but isn't that in total, Cartesian logic, which you're referring to, which is that binary mind, body, left, right, black, white, where we classify any problem as either or, and see that in debate in parliaments and governments. And it's one of the real problems of our time, but that compartmentalization and the reduction of everything to a binary. And one of those, I must confess, is the notion of problem solution. I see that real problem because we've been so inculcated with that culture, especially in the late 90s, early 20th century, in business schools, that it's become the ordained way of dealing with every problem. But some problems don't have solutions, or they need accommodations or solutions rather than solutions. So we need to go back to first principles and rethink even that. So I've diverted. I can't remember the question now.
Well, I was just talking about the cultural aspect of individualism and collectivism.
Well, the cultures are really interesting because that richness is one of the wonderful things about being human, what it means to be human. And I live in Thailand. I'm in the northeast of Thailand at the moment. And it's a collective culture. And you've pointed out the characteristics of those cultures. And the individual nature of it arises in different ways than in the West. So it's still quite inventive and it's still evolving. I do a lot of work in China, and it's the same there, all over this region. And the major difference right at the moment is the energy in this part of the world, the global South generally, and Asia and Southeast Asia, is the different energy in terms of what the future can be, rather than closed off into what it must be, because that was what it was, which is what the predominant view in the West.
Yes, yes. And you've made reference to the Industrial Revolution and the industrial economy. And then there's the whole notion of capitalism. And there's this constant debate about, is capitalism good? Is it bad? Do we need to separate it from crony capitalism? And then looking at socialism as bad. And the other thing I've been reading about is how capitalism often leads to private corporations really taking control and then focusing on their wealth as opposed to for the general population. And I don't know if there's one solution. Again, this goes back to the binary thinking, but are we looking at the wrong problem when we're having these debates, as opposed to looking at some of the solutions you're talking about and innovation, creativity, all of that? Does that get lost in having these debates? So I know I'm throwing a lot of questions at you, but
So fundamentally, when you live inside a paradigm, as we do more or less globally now, industrial economism is a global phenomenon. In other words, making stuff and buying stuff and consuming stuff and more all the time is the dominant religion. It's very difficult to see from within inside that system other alternatives. You can't say, stop the world, I want to get off. But I do think that the fundamental questions that we should be asking are not being asked. So instead of asking questions that kind of skate around on the surface, like, is capitalism good or is it evil, which isn't a useful question to be asking. The kind of question we should be asking is, what kind of economic system would benefit more people? And there's a little tiny tool that I use when I'm making decisions of any kind, which I call the trimunary. And that is what we're doing good for us? Is it good for our children and future generations? And is it good for the planet? So inevitably, I ask the trimunary question in terms of an economy, how can we create an economy that fulfills those three questions in a positive way? and beneficial manner. And it's not the system we've got at the moment. Mm. It's the same with governance. The system of governance we have, and it doesn't matter where you look, you can look at different ideologies and different operational systems, if you like, operating systems. First of all, democracy isn't working anywhere in the world as intended. That's one thing. Whether it would be the solution if it were, I'm not at all sure, given the complexity and scale of the problems we have today. So a whole host of problems still need different answers than go back to first principles and rethink everything, I think.
Mm-hmm. And coming back to the whole system thinking, how do you then strategically design relevant solutions from that perspective then?
Okay, so that's a very granular question because it depends on the circumstances, the situation. One of the things I'm known for is the work I did in the middle 90s and towards the early 2000s within organizations when I was working with large organizations. And that question was being asked at the time. Mm. And what I did was I invented tools and methods which had allowed us to interrogate the whole system in different ways by asking different questions in order to find the systemic acupuncture points. In other words, the points at which you could intervene in the most benign way possible, not the most innovative necessarily, not most destructive or disruptive, but in the most benign way possible, that would predictably change that system. And this little tool called systemic acupuncture, certainly within that context, is one of the tools I use all the time. And it relies on being able to see, identify and visualize the patterns that are under the surface and connect those to see, well, how are those interacting and where could we intervene that would change that?
Mm. Yeah, I like the acupuncture piece of it, just even visualizing it. I think there's a holistic view of it, right? As much as you may think it's a specific point you're targeting, there's connection.
It's not necessarily one point, because when you model it, you might have thought, okay, it doesn't work, so we'll use a different point because now the patterns have changed in this way.
Yes.
Fundamentally, too, Farhan, it's important to understand the difference between leverage and acupuncture, because leverage is a mechanical notion, and it requires effort. And human organizations are not machines. They are, they're organic. They're not machines. Yes.
Yeah, fair enough. So as part of that work, or generally speaking, what lessons do you have for leaders and organizations based on this systemic acupuncture or this way of thinking when you're coming up with solutions?
Oh, the first lesson is, irrespective of where you sit in terms of your status or position, you are not necessarily a leader. Mm. The nomenclature is wrong. Mm. They are managers. And some of them are very good managers, and they manage in a very advanced and sophisticated way. But the whole language of leadership, which came out of the business schools to make more money, essentially, in the late 1950s, early 60s, is wrong. Leadership is a collective, shared phenomenon where people are motivated to get together to improve one or more aspects of the human condition. It's a shared phenomenon. It has nothing to do with power or status. So we need to separate that first of all. The second lesson for those people in positions of authority is to actually find ways to create intelligence within the enterprise, within the organization, and to use that strategic intelligence more intelligently. more wisely. Because at the moment, hierarchies impede that what I call learning metabolism, the speed at which an organization can sense something's happening, make sense of it, and respond appropriately to whatever it is.
And can you expand on that? How are hierarchies limiting that? Because you're having to go through this top-down approach, as opposed to if it was more, I'd say, flattened, that would make it easier to address situations?
Well, if you talk about flat organizations, that creates different problems. But what you've got to understand is an organization is an organic enterprise. It's an organism. And once you understand the organism, then you have to think in terms of viability. What are the systems in the enterprise that allow it to endure and deal with risk and actually create a culture that is beneficial and rather than harmful? I mean, so the viability, I would point your listeners to, if you're really interested in organizational viability, the best person to go to is Stafford Beer and his viable systems model, which was modeled on the human body and is essentially five subsystems that need to interact in order to create a fully operational and effective system that can endure, is viable, in other words. And I use system methodology a lot in organizations. Once, I usually start at CEO or board level, which is just because of habit. That's where it is expected that I interact, although not necessarily. In fact, in my career, I've been on the shop floor, I've done different things in organizations. But once you can cut through the hubris and expectations and habits at board level, and they can see the enterprise differently and can express that differently and communicate that differently within the enterprise in terms of reporting relationships and delegations and all of that, then you can begin to cut through to organizing differently. So the organization can become a viable system in its own right.
And would it be fair to say if you've got that viable system, then it would require minimal interference?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, it requires monitoring. And monitoring the patterns that you see within the business ecosystem. That's not just the organization, but the organization is in a niche and it sits in this business ecosystem. There are lots of other players in that business ecosystem. So you need to understand how those are interacting in real time. And you need people whose job it is to do that. But certainly from a management point of view, management becomes so easy. It really does. I started that when I was working with W. Edwards Deming. I was very fortunate to be able to work with Deming. And we worked, for example, in Boeing. This is going back many, many years. At that stage, the chief notion out of the business school and the consultants were the hierarchy of teams. And it became kind of standard methodology within Boeing. And it was creating no end of problems because projects were going over budget and over time. And it was leading to hugely competitive behavior between the teams, which was deliberate. That was what it was set up to do. And we looked at that very closely and we agreed, well, hang on a moment, they need to collaborate more effectively. That's going to solve some of the problems they have. So systemic acupuncture, we found the easiest solution was actually to appoint a manager whose role it was not to be fixed to any one team. His role was nomadic, peripatetic. So that when teams discovered something new that worked really well, it would be shared immediately with everybody else. And that was his job, to make sure that everyone shared that experience. Mm. And it was extraordinary how it culturally changed the company at that time. It was quite amazing. But I've done similar things in so many different enterprises.
Mm-hmm.
All unique, all different.
Yeah, so it's a bit of the cross-pollination, right? The managers serving that purpose.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So forward-looking now, obviously there's a lot of conversations now with AI. There's fear around AI taking away jobs and jobs becoming redundant. And then some people are making the case that, no, it's going to create more jobs. What is your view on where we're headed now as humans in terms of technology and AI?
With AI, it's both. It already is taking jobs, but that's nothing new. Every new technology has done that. If you look at, as I mentioned, my early career in music, the sound recording engineer no longer exists. That role has disappeared entirely. So that's dynamic. That will always happen. But AI, with one caveat, because right at the moment, the large language models seem to have maxed out on what they can do, and they can do a lot. It's very smart. But AI, to me, is amplified insights. It has nothing to do with intelligence. It's really a reordering of what already exists. Mm. And so what this gives us is yet another opportunity to really focus on what only humans can do. The curiosity, the creativity, the way that we are able to connect ideas that apparently, that, you know, otherwise no apparent connection, but there are, we can find them. There are so many opportunities, and also, to be honest, to find freedom from that working life paradigm where we spend so many hours a week in drudgery, which machines can do faster and better than us, to release ourselves to have more time with family and friends, to actually enjoy living on such an extraordinary planet. So we need to change the fundamentals of human existence and do away with the puritanical notion that work is automatically good for us, when a lot of the work we do is bullshit.
Yeah, fair enough. So what I'm hearing from you is the opportunity that AI would create is to remove work. So then a lot of the common theme that you've been sharing is humans can actually focus on building relationships and not so much on work that is separating them away from their families, their communities, society at large.
Yes, I think work is still important. It is, working is a wonderful impulse if you enjoy doing it and it is your life. But when it becomes a drudgery, and that drudgery can be done better by a machine, then give it to the machine and do something different.
Right. Yeah, and many clients I work with in the therapeutic standpoint, part of their pain point is exactly what you're saying, is work feels like a chore. It's not something that they enjoy. But that's where that conversation of purpose comes up again. So is it fair to say if you can give it to the machine, that allows you to then focus on your unique purpose, whatever that may be, that allows you to feel fulfilled, which then also improves your personal connection with yourself, but then even the relationships you have?
Yes, that is so. But again, there's a caveat, because the conditions around you need to be able to support you in doing And right at the moment, we go back to the paradigm we're in. That's not the friendly paradigm to that new way of living. And so one of the things we have to do at a societal level is to be able to create the conditions whereby that new essence of what a human being actually is can be fulfilled and can burgeon and take off.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And a lot of the times we get stuck in this debate again about creating utopia and how the utopian state is not what we truly desire as humans, because we always need some sort of friction. And a lot of thinkers in the past have talked about the downside of having utopia. But this is not what we're talking about. We're talking about a way of living that is still challenging you and allowing you to grow, but at the same time, you're living in harmony with everyone around you.
Yes, and there's a sense of fulfillment. Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely critical. I mean, I have been so lucky. I've done so many different things, mm-hmm. and I've suffered relationship breakups and divorce. Mm-hmm. I've sacked. I've lost my job. I've moved from one continent to another. And I've gone through various traumatic experiences, and that's part of being human too. Pain is, I think, a critical component of what it means to be human, because without pain, there is no measure of pleasure or joy. But I really do think that fulfillment, you don't escape being human.
Yes.
So that's not possible. But what you do is you create the conditions whereby your feelings are more rounded and your sense of fulfillment is there. I think that's so important, because a lot of crime, a lot of loneliness, a lot of that, I mean, we've got a pandemic of loneliness at the moment, but a lot of the ailments in society at the moment are the result of not being able to feel fulfilled in terms of our life.
Yeah, absolutely. And is it fair to say, so, you know, we've talked about the Industrial Revolution. You can look back at the Agricultural Revolution. Do you feel like we're at a similar turning point as a civilization where there's a new revolution coming in place, or we've already passed that, and then in hindsight, we could probably say that, yeah, this was the point. We just don't know that yet.
I think we're in the chrysalis, in a state of dissolution, and it's, you have to remember, excuse me, that dissolving of the old is part and parcel of forming the new. So all doom and gloom, that what is collapsing and what is failing has to fail and has to collapse in order for the new to evolve. So I think we're in the middle of that now. Having lived 80 years and watched this acceleration in the factors that cause failure and collapse, I'm now convinced that we're beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel, and the darkest moment. But I am optimistic in that sense.
So are you saying that we're still yet to go through the darkest moment, or we're in the midst of it?
I think we're in the midst of it at the moment. I think what we're seeing around the world in terms of conflict and war particularly, and no, I can't say that. Well, what we're seeing at the moment is probably the darkest moment, the dark night of the soul of being human.
And you're talking more at a collective level, but I feel like even individually, we all kind of go through those dark night of the soul moments. I know I've gone through some of that, and those, what emerges is something beautiful. But as you're talking about, when you're in it, it is painful, because the old is dying, it's dissolving, and what's emerging is something powerful. And not a lot of people can withhold that. And I think one of the things we talk about in therapy is pain may seem like it's not optional, but suffering is optional. And a lot of the times we choose that suffering instead of powering through it. What are your thoughts on that piece, and how many of those critical points have you experienced in your life? I know you've talked about experiencing failure, right? Whether it's relational or career-wise too, but what has emerged from those moments in your life?
Well, I've been very resilient ever since at the age of 8, I lost my dad. And living in England at the time, he ran off with another woman. And in that culture at that time, that was forbidden. Nobody talked about it. And so it was, for me, that was a huge loss. And I agree with you. I think the anguish that we deal with as humans is part of being human. But one of the problems, again, we have is industrial society tells us that if we buy more stuff, we'll be okay. We'll feel better. Go and upgrade your iPhone. You'll feel better about it. Take a holiday. Or if you're depressed, go on some drugs. That'll sort things out. Instead of, again, thinking through, well, what are we actually missing? If we go to indigenous societies and understand the wisdom of a lot of those First Nations people, then they already had solutions before we created a pharmaceutical industry. Going back to nature, actually being in nature, is one of those. Literally, I mean, taking your shoes off and standing in the earth and not resorting to a pill when there are other things that are more important. And certainly, as you will know, the general research into depression comes back to who are your friends? What do you talk about to your friends? How often do you see your friends? What's your social milieu? Because that's absolutely critical. Relationship.
Yes. Yeah. In addition to relationships, I think a lot of the research I've come across too is having a sense of gratitude, which I often translate into service as well. And we don't often focus on that, is how am I serving other people? And it doesn't always have to be monetary. It could be with our time, with our skills. And I think we've lost sight of that too. So I agree. I think it's both. And in that form of service, it also allows us to build better connections with people.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, as you know, I live in Bangkok. And when I go into the city, there are quite a few homeless people begging. And so, yes, I will give someone 20 baht, but I will sit down, I'll smile, I'll try and talk to them. I might get them a drink or a sandwich or something, and try and engage them in a more optimistic view of, here am I, another human being, and I want to talk to you. You matter to me. You're important. And I think the satisfaction I get from that is enormous. You can't measure it.
No, I agree. It's beautiful. What gives you hope then about, I know you've touched on a lot of things around how this is a crucial turning point we're going through as a civilization, but what gives you hope on the other side of it?
Living in this region particularly, where there's a very different kind of energy in terms of the future, which is seeing more evolution than dissolution. I think it's the Western paradigm that's really collapsing. And so, yes, we're affected by it here, but there are other things emerging fast. If you just go to Shenzhen, for example, for a lot of Western people, it's the cultural shock would be immense, because it's like stepping 30 years into the future. Everything is clean. People are smiling. Everything is friendly. You want help, you get help. And it's a futuristic landscape as well. And the whole notion of calm and peace is on everybody's lips, not war and conflict and bombing and enemy. The language here is very different. The second thing that gives me hope is youth. If we can release them from the incumbent patriarchy of my age, that because we exist and because we've created a lot of the problems, seem to believe that we also have the solutions. We need to get out of the way And yes, be available for advice or wisdom if we have it, but allow young people to do the work that needs to be done. Mm. Rather than trying to say, you don't know, we know, listen to us.
Mm. And a lot of the things that you're talking about and encouraging to the listeners and myself, what comes up for me is a sense of unity, right? And a form of love that I feel like is missing, right? Because you were giving the example of the otherization, which often leads to war. But if we were to come together and have this shared sense of purpose and love and community, things would change. And for me, I've been able to find that in terms of my own spiritual connection. And I feel sometimes when that's missing, it's easier for us to turn against each other, because the way I've been able to visualize it through conversations with other people is, if I can improve my vertical relationship, that helps my horizontal relationships. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? What keeps you grounded? How do you find that in your life?
That's actually not an easy question. I'm a pacifist. Mm. Always have been. I don't understand violence, particularly violence and aggression from men to anybody. I simply don't understand that. And when I was at school, one of the things that hit me hard was the difference between how Darwin's ideas were taken and misunderstood and promoted, and a naturalist who lived around the same time, Peter Kropotkin, a Russian, who did most of his research in Siberia and cold climates rather than the warm waters of the South Pacific, who saw that both within and between communities, it was cooperation that ensured survival. And that always made sense to me. And when I'm addressing an audience, and I do a lot of public speaking, as you know, and anything 500 to 1,000 people at any one time, one of the things that very often catches me out is when I stand at the lectern, the applause, I've been introduced, the applause dies down, and I look at my audience, I just see humanity. And on several occasions, that's choked me up, and I haven't been able to start for several seconds because of the love, not that I feel for them, but that I sense from them to me. And I think one of the important things is a lot of the feelings and sensations that would allow us to connect differently with each other have been suppressed by the society we're in today, that materialistic, competitive notion of we must be growing economically all the time and what's your GDP now. It's suppressed a lot of the instinct in terms of caring for each other.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I appreciate that. So this is a bit unique. I'm going to do rapid fire questions here. This is something we haven't done on the podcast before, right? But I've got four questions and I want to see what comes up for you right off the bat. But if you had to share any book or books and ideas to the audience, what would they be to get them inspired?
Oh my goodness. Oh, rapid fire. Oh no. Goodness me. I have read so much in my life. I mean, I've just read so much. There's not one book comes through at all. There are so many. I guess rapid fire, it would have to be the Oxford English Dictionary.
Okay. And why is that?
Because it's given me the language to be very precise about how I express ideas which are not common.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Next one. I think this might be easier, I hope. In terms of leadership, what would be one quality that you would suggest to people to focus on?
Stewardship, not leadership. Stewardship. It's about caring for each other in the environment. It's absolutely critical. It is the number one.
Okay, perfect. Next one. For society and future, what would you offer for us to think about?
Humility. Humility as a species, and not believing that we are everything that other life is not.
Mm. And then the last one, what are your personal reflections based on things that you've been thinking about lately?
Oh dear, I have so many ideas going around in my mind all the time. The most important one is the philosophy I've been working on now for 5 to 6 years. It's called ecority, and it's some portmanteau word, shoving ecology together with security. And the greatest threat to human security is our treatment of the planet. Mm-hmm. And for me, there is one planet. This is our home. We need to care for it and look after it. And so ecority is the philosophy of relating to each other and to the planet in ways that are beneficial.
Mm. Amazing. Thank you so much, Richard, for this conversation. I learned so much. I've taken so many notes that I need to go look up things and learn about. But and thank you for your wisdom. I really value talking to people such as yourself who've been around for a while, right? And I don't say that as a joke. I think it's important to acknowledge that. I think sometimes we dispense with the wisdom that people like yourself have to offer. So to me, this is a gift to be able to talk to you and learn from you. And I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. Can I leave you with one thought? Because
yes.
It comes back to that sense of fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
When I was going through med school, I got a scholarship and I was studying medicine, but I still needed to work. So I was in England and I got a job as a milkman. You get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you have this electronic milk float and you deliver milk door to door in bottles. And I was doing this for about 2 months and I would do it quickly. So I'd run and then I'd have to drink some of the milk that I was carrying, and I could never balance the books. And after 2 months, the general manager in the dairy called me and he said, lad, he called me lad all the time. Mm. Could never remember names, I don't think. He said, lad, I've got to let you go. And I said, what do you mean? He said, I'm giving you the sack. You can't balance the books. I'm sorry. I don't, you know, you've got, I can't have you around. And he said, well, I'm going to give you some advice. And bearing in mind, I was studying medicine at the time and ecology in particular. He said, if you can't do this job, you'll never amount to anything.
Mm.
That was the advice I got. And I decided that would not be the case. And I think everyone has to have that moment where you think that will not be the case because I am who I am and I'll show people.
Yeah. No, and that brings up memories for me as well, where I've had those moments where I've been challenged and I've taken it on. Right. And I think it goes back to your point earlier about resilience. And I think we need to foster that. Unfortunately, I see a lack of resilience at times in my conversations with people. And to your point also around that we've found easy solutions or shortcuts to not seek and build resilience. So I hope we continue to do that.
That's true. And remember, Farhan, that the real thing there is, I say to a lot of people, it's not your fault. We need to create the conditions for you to be the person you really are.
Yes.
It's important.
Yes, absolutely.
It's been a joy talking to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, and final, like just to, before we end this, if people wanted to learn more about your work, find your writing, what are some ways they can do that?
The easiest go-to is the website, which contains everything.
Yes.
Which is www.richardhames.com.
All right. Well, we'll put that in the show notes for listeners to learn more about you and your work. But yes, thank you again.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you again for checking out this episode with Richard. As always, please subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. That's the best and easiest way to support this podcast. And on Apple and Spotify, you can leave up to a 5-star review. Please check out the sponsors in the description, as well as the Easy Reflections newsletter, a zero-cost newsletter that goes out weekly, where I explore different mental health topics and provide practical tips and insights for the reader to implement. The link to the newsletter can be found in the show note captions, where you can subscribe directly. Thank you again, and until next time.